Hey everybody, it's Axel. Before we get started, I just wanted to remind you that we are on Patreon. We've been doing a ton of podcasts. This season, we've been averaging about 5 podcasts a week for the Game of Thrones season. And guess what? We're not slowing down. We're doing a new podcast on David Simon's new HBO show, The Deuce. DJ is coming out with his own show, Inside DJ's DVR. We've got more podcasts, Winterfell, to give to you. Man, I'm already sitting on 2 or 3 podcasts that we recorded already. And if you were a patron, you'd already be listening to some of them. We're also going to be doing great podcasts just for patrons in the off season as well. We're really going to have a lot more time to do a large variety of stuff, as well as keeping with the podcast Winterfell, Game of Thrones type of stuff that you've come to enjoy. So check us out, Patreon.com/DVR. We're all independent podcasters doing this on our own time. So help us out. Support us. Become a part of the crew. Take care. Dedicated to Game of Thrones and A Song of Ice and Fire, you're listening to Podcast Winterfell, part of the DVR Podcast Network. Check us out at DVRpodcast.com.
Welcome everybody to Podcast Winterfell. This is Mike. I usually do the deep dive with Tracy. We are doing something special today. We're doing an interview with Kevin Uhaldi, who is an associate professor of history. Did I say that right?
That's correct.
Okay, good. I saw a bunch of articles, you know, talking to Kevin about the Game of Thrones and about George and about his philosophy of history and about, oh, it's just really good, smart stuff. So we're going to talk about that today. If you are a new listener, welcome. We've picked up a lot of people over the course of this season, and now you're finding out what we do when the show's not on. This is when we go deep, is between seasons when we get into this stuff. So we're going to do a little bit of that today with an interview. You watch Game of Thrones, I assume, right? You're not just picking all this stuff up from Twitter?
Yes, I've watched them all.
All right, good.
I helped for a while because I didn't have HBO, but I finally caved in and caught up really quickly.
It's
and just
bingeable.
Finished the most recent season, yeah.
Yeah, it's a very bingeable show. Why don't you do a better job of explaining who you are than I just did before we start talking about the show then?
Sure. I do teach history at Ohio University. I've been here for a long time, since 2002. And before that, I taught at Northern Illinois University for a few years. And actually, the person who succeeded me there, Valerie Garber, she has a whole seminar in the history department on Game of Thrones and medieval history. And here I actually teach a course. It's a large introduction course on medieval history and film, which is sort of, it's half medievalism and popular medieval culture and then half medieval history. And I try to get people to help people to be able to read or watch popular history, especially medieval things, with a critical eye, I guess. And a critical eye for me is, and what I tell people in that class, is to be able to appreciate what shows or video games or popular literature does well. Of course, it's really easy to find what they do wrong from a historical perspective, and that's just something I've never really been into. So my own research has nothing to do with any of that, really. I work on early Christianity and the later Roman Empire, and specifically on legal culture. And I've written a book and a couple articles on that, and that's what my scholarship continues to be on. So things like Game of Thrones, when something like that comes along and gets popular, it really enhances the fun that I have teaching, even in, especially because it's not directly related to my scholarship. Yeah.
right. People aren't necessarily asking you to pick all the nits. Is that the real value of kind of, I guess, history and popular culture? I'm not really sure how else to say it. Like, basically kind of bringing people into the academic field who wouldn't otherwise? Or it's also like, I mean, you guys just enjoy it too, right? Like, I mean, it's, you know, everybody needs a little escapism, no?
Exactly. And I don't, you know, everyone's different. And it's certainly true that, you know, a lot of historians get really excited when they're not only with fantasy and things like Game of Thrones or the video game stuff that my son introduces me to now, but also when you have a new movie, you know, like a new World War II movie like Dunkirk or something like that. Historians do get excited about people coming into their classes and then that being a way of getting people interested in history. I have to say for myself, what I find useful and fun about that is not so much trying to convert people to history, but if it's something good, and I think Game of Thrones, the books, and at least up until the last season, the TV show, what I think is good about them is it actually allows you with students in a class or with friends over beers to talk about the aspects of history, I think, that are actually interesting to everyone even if they don't know about it right away. You know, some of the things I think we'll talk about today. But the role of sort of the great man, or in Game of Thrones, the great woman figures, what Hegel calls the world historical individuals, versus the forces of history or ordinary people, right? Those kind of things that people often don't know they're really interested in. But if you watch something like Game of Thrones, it gives you a rich universe that people are into for whatever reason, then you can start asking these questions. And I find it's, you know, leads to really good conversations.
Yeah. I mean, the whole great man trends and forces conversation, like, I could just spend the rest of my life talking about that and be totally content. I just, like, I have right. to eat and go outside sometimes. But, you know, I find that really fascinating, that conversation fascinating in any facet. And yeah, I think that's a really excellent point. People care about stuff like that even though they don't know about it. Or they right. don't know that there's, like, a whole history of the study of this particular, you know. So what is interesting to history about you, you know, to you? You said that you, your book is about law, mm-hmm. and you said your study is primarily about law and the kind of the early Christian. That's, I will say, esoteric, right? Uh-huh. Like, I mean, that's, I assume, like, a fairly small field. You might even have the email address of everybody else who's really smart about that. I don't know. I mean, what is it that kind of, that interests you? Because I have to assume that there's some, in some way you feel it relates to your modern life, to your day-to-day existence.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, there's a difference between, the way I think of it, at least, is there's a difference between why I do history and what I do when I'm doing history. And what I do when I'm doing history is basically solve problems. And since, you know, there are really big thinkers out there who solve really large, or at least try to solve really large historical problems, I'm not one of them. So I can really only focus on sort of small problems that are solvable. And that's what so why I end up, for example, you know, doing my dissertation and writing my first book on the role of bishops in law is, you know, honestly just a matter of sort of circumstances. When it's at the point that I started research and writing, that's the kind of source material I was working with. And I found it interesting and I could identify problems that really hadn't been satisfactorily answered. So I did that. And in that sense, you know, history, at least the way I see it, history is problem solving and being part of sort of a profession or a, you know, a scholarly field that you're not necessarily trying to solve every problem. You're just making a contribution to the one that you can. However, I don't think that would be extremely esoteric and could feel very isolated. So I think that's what I do. But the reason why I do it, and the reason why I think a lot of historians do it, is because we are actually interested in much bigger questions, much bigger issues. And even though, you know, I'm not a philosopher, you know, and we might end up talking a little bit about philosophy of history or people like Hegel, I'm not a Hegel scholar, right? I'm not. So I'm really an amateur, I feel, when it comes to those things. But those are the things that motivate me and move me, right? You know, and I think the same, you know, it can be analogous to a lot of other jobs. You know, someone may be really into, you know, you're really motivated by large scale CGI movies, the spectacle of creating that sort of art form, and that ends up being your job. But what you do is sit in front of a computer and write code, right? So what you're doing doesn't look like why you want to do it. And hopefully you don't one day grow despondent over realizing that you're really just sitting in programming. Hopefully those things work together, right? And that's what enriches your life. And in that way, you know, history is a lot like everyone's life, I hope, or at least what we aim for. Yeah. What we find ourselves doing day to day, it's enriching and enriched because we have sort of a, you know, we have these larger interests and motivations and passions, and sometimes we can lose sight of those, and hopefully that's, you know, we can reconnect. Yeah. So there is a disconnect there. But I think that's how I deal with it, at least.
Yeah. You know, this is something I haven't really been a big fantasy reader or watcher in my life. And then, you know, so I'm coming to this kind of massive genre late, you know, and I would just kind of be more likely to read the source material, you know, or analysis of the source material than to read sort of narrative, you know, fiction recreations, right? And in a lot of ways, via my wife and George Martin, I have found this world that I didn't know about, you know, or that I didn't respect, frankly, I didn't value, you know, excuse me. And I think, like, I'm glad that I kind of prepared myself with, you know, years of reading the history before, because I think that made it easier for me to connect. But there really is something to the universality of emotion and the universality of the kind of, physical almost response, right, to certain things. And, you know, that stuff is just not embodied in the writings about Alexander or, you know, there's obviously, like, some early writers have more of that than others, you know, but the way that we expect stories to be told today, you know, they weren't told that way then, right? And so there, I have found it really interesting to kind of plug into the daily emotional life through fantasy and, you know, historical fiction in a different way than I ever had before. And I think that Game of Thrones does a really interesting job of that, because too much magic and I'm starting, like, I don't, these people are shooting lightning bolts out of their fingertips. Like, I'm start to lose interest at that point, you know, and George has made it so much more about politics and about jealousy and, you know, about just kind of that gritty human emotion that's much easier to relate to. And so you feel like the show, or generally in your academic circles, I guess, right? It seems like the show is fairly accurate. I mean, I kind of want to let's talk a little bit about William the Conqueror, right? And because that's something that gets referenced, the Andal invasion and, you know, the Anglo-Saxon, right? And that's something that gets referenced in the fan community around Game of Thrones a lot. So I'd be interested to hear, because you've talked about that in the Slate article. We'll link some of the articles that we've read and that we'll talk about today in the show notes so everybody can see them. You talk about that specifically in the Slate article. So take us through the history of that a little bit and how you think it relates to the show.
Right. Well, that was a year ago that I did that article. And actually, I'm surprised that I've done more interviews since then, because, you know, when I was given the article, when I was told it was posted, I went and looked and I saw several errors that were, maybe that was an oral interview that then was written up, and I saw several errors. So I don't know where they got. Some of it was to do with punctuation and things like that, which it was natural. But by the time I emailed the author and said, oh, you know, you might want to correct these, by the time the person got the email, there are already all these comments appearing at the bottom, really damning me to hell for, I think at one point, confusing Harold Hardrada and Harold Goblinson and, you know,
Unforgiven. Oh, how dare you.
But what was funny about it is that one of the things that I don't know if it's in the article or something, but we certainly talked about when I did that interview was, one way to approach shows like this, and also to, you know, much more obviously to approach, say, things like Dunkirk, that is movies that, or shows that are really trying, or historical fiction that really is trying to be historical fiction. This, of course, is fantasy, which allows a lot of leeway and freedom from, you know, getting hung up on accuracies and inaccuracies. But one way to approach shows is what we said in the beginning, right? Is the nitpicking and trying to find precise parallels between, in this case, you know, a fantasy world and a historical world. And that's really not where, you know, that's not where I'm inclined to go. It's certainly not how I watch the show or read the books. However, and if I were, then I would know that, you know, like that this, I've, even before I read the books, right, I was told that this is the War of the Roses, right? So this is a, this
right.
is really,
this is like 2 weeks in the War of the Roses. The War of the Roses was long.
So it's not, it was very late medieval at best. But I think what's successful about the book is you can read, you know, you can read all sorts of historical parallels in there because they're kind of, you know, the, in some ways the figures are more, you know, like symbols or allegories, if you want, than no historical parallels. However, all of that said, you know, Westeros looks like the British Isles, more or less, or at least Britain. I guess there's no Ireland there. There's definitely, you know, all sorts of parallels. The wall looks like Hadrian's Wall. Some of the cultural differences between the South and the North seem to resemble medieval Britain. When it comes to William the Conqueror or the Anglo-Saxons before William the Conqueror, William the Conqueror, of course, is an Anglo-Norman, or he's just a Norman before the invasions. When he comes, you're seeing someone with it's someone who is culturally by that point French speaking goes through a lot of effort of trying to wipe out the Saxon nobility, anyone who won't go along right away, and establishing his own nobles throughout England and trying to tighten his control the way that no one is able to in the Game of Thrones show, right? But people like Cersei would love to do.
So France is not exactly Essos, but nonetheless, it is a foreign land.
Yeah.
With somewhat foreign customs.
Exactly. And so you have this, what you have there is a culture that's sort of sitting on top of another culture, right? Famously for generations, right? In the English court, people were more likely to be speaking French than to be speaking English. And it's why, even though, you know, modern English is a Germanic language, the vast majority of the vocabulary in modern English is French. However, if you go back to the Anglo-Saxon migrations or invasions, especially from the 9th century and earlier, from the 5th and 6th centuries and into the 7th centuries, one of the things that we find out now is that you really do, through DNA, we can actually track the fact that there was a lot of intermarriage with those groups, that it happened fairly slowly. But we can also see that some of what we read in our literary sources is confirmed even today by DNA evidence. So, for example, there seems to be a higher preponderance of DNA links to to the Saxon areas in Eastern England than in the West or in the North, which suggests that, just like our literary sources tell us, that's where the concentrations were heaviest. However, you don't find any you don't find pure Saxons, you don't find pure Britons, and what it's clear is that you have intermarriage, which my understanding of the West, the fantasy Westeros, right, is that's sort of the Andals are have intermarried, and you have those groups
the first are men.
Exactly.
Right. And there's a higher concentration of Andals in the South because they came across the Broken Arm in the South and you know, pushed their way up. And right. So you have, and that's another thing that, you know, we know from history is that there's not just one day, or very rarely, right, where there's just one day where a group shows up and just displaces this other group. You have years of intermarriage leading up to it, so they're at least have a place to land the boats, right, when they come over. And then after, you know, for instance, Hastings, there were lots of battles after that, right? And you know, and settling rebellions and stuff like that. And you know, so it's not one of these things that takes a day. And that's one thing that I find just kind of really fascinating about history is the way that, you know, 500 years will be reduced to a paragraph. And there's just so much to unpack there, right? And that suits the purposes of that historian in the moment. And I don't mean to say that like it's a failing, but, you know, everything that I've read has left so much, you know, unexplained, right? Because how are you going to encompass everything? You know, you got to leave something out. I mean, that's, you know, right? So, exactly. but that idea of the kind of slow, that idea of watching it in the show, you know, you see the Dothraki just kind of arrive out of nowhere, which was kind of Mongol style, right? They didn't really intermarry for soft targets. They just kind of showed up out of nowhere. But everybody else is using the power of intermarriage and talking about bending the knee. And I don't know if you've explored the histories and lore from the show and like the DVDs, and they're all on YouTube and all that stuff, but there is a lot of talk about the Starks bending the knee, to, you know, in the moment that they, right. And that kind of when the intermarriage really, you know, when they really became a part of the larger kingdom, you know, anyway, I don't know. So what, you have this quote here. Let me say this right. Let me not mess this up. 'Cause I'm likely to.
Well, like freedom. I said, I messed up a lot of stuff apparently in the interview, but go ahead.
Freedom was a tool, and Daenerys has shown herself to be a savvy leader. Hegel argues that social change usually happens in spite of successful leaders like Alexander the Great and Julius Caesar, and that they actually end up being destroyed by that change. So we have two major things here. First, I want to talk about this idea of freedom as a tool. And we've talked about this a lot in the show, which is, or, you know, in our episodes, podcasts and stuff, talking about the show, which is, what does it mean to break the wheel? You know, she's forever talking about this, but she hasn't laid out a plan, I guess we would say, right? She doesn't have a 30-point plan for what breaking the wheel, how that actually affects people in their day-to-day life. I spent most of this season and most of the last two seasons, frankly, really frustrated by that just kind of being a slogan, a meaningless slogan, right? Mm-hmm. But I read these books and I read interviews with George Martin, and he talks about, you know, how the effect of monarchy on the little people, right, and on common people, and how, you know, you could just be overruled and just killed at any minute, right? And so the more I think about it and the more I kind of read him talking about it, the more it seems to me that her not knowing what breaking the wheel means is not a failure of the books. It's the point. It's the whole purpose is that it's not clear, and that there is this kind of constant effort. You know, we see in today's world, right, that it's not like our kind of intellectual or our gains in freedom can't be rolled back. You know, and that's a part of our conversation in our contemporary world Very much so, right? So I like this idea of freedom as you say as a tool, right? And I'm thinking of it as a slogan, which is kind of the same thing in the political world, right? Slogans are tools.
Yeah. No, it's and one of the things, you know, if you say it's if I say it's a tool, then of course that makes it sound cynical. Like you assume then that Daenerys doesn't actually believe it, right? And I don't think that's the case. I don't think you can know. And in fact, in that way, with that character, you're very similar to a position you would be in with a historical figure, right? You can't even a contemporary politician, right? Like, how do you tell when someone says this is what they believe in, right? You'd be naive to think that they truly believe that. And you'd also be very cynical to assume that they don't believe things because everyone believes something. And I think so you have that with Harris. So saying it's a tool means that, you know, whether she believes it or not, it's clear in, you know, that was in the, TV show, that interview was from sort of the end of season six. So it was sort of this, you know, what's going to happen next. And now we know that she gets on it. You know, there's been almost no talk of freedom since then. So it would have probably changed the conversation if we knew that's what was going to happen. But the idea of it, you know, one way or another, it's clear that, you know, the promise of freedom is something that's key to her authority in that period. And there's plenty of historical analogs for that. There's, I think in that interview, I think because I just been talking to my wife, Jackie Maxwell, she's a historian too, and teaches ancient history here. And so she had mentioned, Athens declaring Sparta's slaves, the Helots, free during the Peloponnesian War, right? Mm-hmm. That is clearly, or at least in the version we have from Thucydides, that's clearly a tool, right? That Athens doesn't give a shit about whether they're free or not, and Athens has its own slaves. So that's clearly a lever in the war. Another example would be, it's not quite freedom, but it would be a famous example would be Julius Caesar in the Roman Republic, and promising all these things and delivering on many things to the plebs, to the regular people of Rome, and sort of what today people would say fomenting class warfare. And that's a closer, you know, parallel, or closer case to where, you know, maybe he does believe that, but it's also clearly politically advantageous. So it's really hard, you know, what's fascinating me. And of course, this is, again, what I like about teaching history. That's very different from what I would do in my scholarship, is to say, not to draw like historical parallels in this, you know, and with the past and the present, and then you get caught up in all of these, you know, well, to what degree are they the same or different, and all those questions of accuracy. But just in broad terms, say, you know, we are faced often with historical figures with the same conundrum that we are with modern political figures or with our own friends, right? Like, how do we judge what their motives are, and does it really matter? You know, because I would say that in the end with Daenerys, it seems like she's sincere, but of course the only reason we think that is because of the perspective, the author's perspective that we have, that is obviously sympathetic, right? We are supposed to sympathize with her. We get glimpses of what she looks like from the outside from other people, and it's obviously quite different. But we're willing to believe that, but in the end, it doesn't matter. I mean, this is in that case, the promise of freedom is something that's really important to her political power. And that's just a fact. And then as far as, you know, saying, can she deliver on that promise? Then I think it's really interesting that you see that Daenerys is a person who, again, is very believable, a person who is, whether she's thinking strategically or on principle or both, she's really only thinking about the breaking of the wheel. She's thinking about, you know, mixing things up or big dramatic gestures. And of course, just like you were talking about with, you know, William the Conqueror, you know, winning the Battle of Hastings is only step one. And what we do know about William the Conqueror is actually he was very up to the task of dealing with the much more tedious and long lasting work of tightening his control sort of in terms of administration and building loyalty, that he was up to that task, right? And people resented him for it, but that's mm-hmm. what the Anglo-Norman kingdom. Daenerys clearly is not up to, like, she's not interested in that, right? And part of that may be because of, like, a personal, you know, quirk that she's focused on the short term, which is not strange, right? That mm-hmm. we see plenty of people who are good at, you know, breaking things but don't know how to build things. And it also could be this fact that ultimately through that, you know, the whole middle, well, all the way up to the end of season six, right, she's really just focused on Westeros and the Iron Throne. So she may believe these things in the moment, right, but really her mind is always, you know, this is all temporary for her. That she's moving on.
But really the only character we've seen so far in that show who is particularly good at administration is Tywin, right? I mean, you know, Ned was like, you know, if you pass the sentence, you got to swing the sword. Like, you know, there's been different people who have been good at different things, but Tywin mm-hmm. really is really the only character that's had that, that's really seen to have that tight administrative control, and the Lannisters are seen to be the real power behind the throne until they actually had it. Wow, I hadn't really thought about it that way. That's a great point. There aren't many administrators.
What's so great about his... I mean, that's one of the great things about the, you know, the Martin's book and the world. And this is what really, I read the books before the shows. It's one of the few times, you know, it was like a Da Vinci Code many years ago where students kept asking me if I'd read this and then were very disappointed that I hadn't. And so finally I read the Da Vinci Code because I teach early Christianity. That's why that book kept coming up. You know, that was disappointing. That felt like homework. But then Game of Thrones was similar. It kept coming up. And then one summer, just before the most recent book came out, I read, you know, all of them at once. And what I was telling my wife Jackie at the time and other people that I liked so much about it, about the book, especially the first one, was how that the people that really mattered, that were making things happen, were sort of the second tier of the power structures or the households everywhere. Yep. And especially, you know, within the monarchy. And that, you know, again, I do late Roman history. So this is something that was, even though I knew, like I said, this is supposed to be the War of the Roses, I thought, well, this is a lot like, you know, late Roman history, 4th and 5th century, where we know that the imperial court or the consistory, the people around the emperor, really were the people, like, you had to, if you were an actor, they were the people you had to think about, because they controlled access to the emperor. They were the ones who were advising the emperors, right? And it was a political structure that was required a lot of maneuvering, a lot of you know, persuasive power or bribery. And of course, it's not unique to the late Roman Empire, but that focus is so rare, right? To focus on those on that kind of level. It reminds me also of another, you know, the novelist Hilary Mantel and her The Wolf Hall in that series. That's another kind of example to me where on the one hand, there's something really historically realistic, at least from my perspective, where you have, you know, you're not, where no individual, right, is completely autonomous, no matter how powerful or cruel or whatever they are. And then on the other hand, people like Martin or Hilary Mantel can do what historians usually can't do, and get inside people's heads and, you know, at least speculate on motivations and personalities. And ultimately, you know, when you said earlier about how, you know, you could read books of writings about Alexander the Great or something like that, but people don't in the past, stories aren't told the way they're told today, and that's why more people are going to read, you know, fantasy literature rather mm-hmm. than primary sources. I don't think that's always true. I mean, there are ancient people were really interested in smut and sinister motives and things like that too. But certainly it applies to history books. And I think that's because, you know, ultimately, like we were saying, like I was saying with Daenerys, like we know that personal motives matter, but that's the one thing you can never get at, right, in the industry, almost very, very rarely. And that's where I think, you know, whether it's historical fiction like Hilary Mantel or fantasy like Martin, I think that's what's compelling is that they can do things that historians don't dare do, at least in their scholarly work.
But like a lot of historians really like that stuff, right? This is a thing I'm figuring out, because that was part of why I was never really that into it, is because I never thought like serious people were. You know, like this is the impression I got. I don't know, when I'm like 13 or something. I have no idea. But
about yourself, I mean, I don't read fantasy literature as a rule. I read Tolkien, Hobbit and Lord of the Rings maybe twice through when I was a kid, and then that was it. I've never been a big science fiction reader. I read the Dune series when I was a kid, and some other. Philip Dick and others later on, but I've never been a big fantasy or sci-fi reader. And what made me the exception, something like Game of Thrones, is not so much that I'm attracted to fantasy literature. It's, you know, it's the narrative it's the way that the story's told. And what I think is so successful about Game of Thrones as a reader and as a historian has to do with just some of the things like you were talking about before, these issues, these long term issues that would be really boring to write a novel about, like how for centuries and centuries the Andals intermarry and culturally assimilate with to different degrees with various populations around Westeros. Right. I mean, even my attempt at describing such a book is but the brilliance of the, but we also know, and Martin knows, that that's how the world of Westeros, that's how it has the present tense. That's how it was created. And so one of the things that I think is so great about the book is how you are constantly reminded, whether it's from, you know, the people reading books in the septum, or whether it's the stories or tales that people tell, whether it's the crypt or whether it's the ruins of these ruinous old castles, you're constantly reminded that this world is super, super long. Right. Yeah. And the history is really, really long. And there's also ways of, you know, tucking in, you know, history into all that, which will satisfy the people who want to reconstruct the whole world, you know, but it's all tucked into a narrative, into a story, because like you said before, historians are bound by the same constriction that fiction writers are, which is that you have to put it between covers. You have to have a page one and a, you know, final page, and one way or another, it's a narrative, right? Even if you make
I think
it,
George might be trying to break that rule.
You think so? Yeah, that's true. Well, I think, and you know, that's what I think is actually, I don't know, like with the season seven, one of the things I like about writing, is that, you know, he, for whatever reason, I don't actually read, I've read almost no interviews, I don't think, about him. I've read references to interviews with him, but I don't read around Game of Thrones very much. I've mainly watched the books or watched the shows and read the books. But I really like that, you know, in the world of literature, if you're not done with a book, then you're not done with a book. Right. Whereas the HBO has no choice. They've got a contract, they've got viewers, and they've got to forge ahead. So yeah, I don't know. You know, maybe he's just, you know, had writer block or whatever. But
I don't know. I'm excited to read him, but I don't want to. He just needs to tell me when it's done. I'm not really in any mood to start telling him when it's done.
Right.
You know, I mean, I don't. I find that kind of attitude about his creative process very strange. You know, like there's a lot of kids and it's like Christmas morning and they are waiting for the sun to come up. And it's like, come on, you know.
Yeah.
Let's Is there any, I think, okay, let's talk about this Transit Forces thing, but we're going to keep it short because unless you correct me, I don't think there's really a great example of it in the show because the show is so focused on the individual characters. But the overall idea is that, you know, there are individuals who have, you know, amassed a great deal of power or influence through, you know, one thing or another. It's usually tends to kind of be focused on their personality. Once upon a time, it was focused on their on assumptions of their divinity, right? We don't usually talk about it that way now. We usually kind of talk about them as being, you know, very, whatever, fascinating people, you know, people who, leaders of men, you know, right? It's kind of a common phrase. And so then there is these kind of larger movements in history where you see slavery being outlawed in, you know, different developed countries around the world all within 100 years or so, right? Mm-hmm. And so something like that is not driven by an individual necessarily because it's happening all over the world. And so there's this kind of ongoing constant conversation in history about which of these things is kind of more powerful. And I think everybody realizes it's a little bit of both. And in many ways, these great people, these leaders of men are riding the wave of, you know, these kind of trends that are happening. And so just to talk about Julius Caesar, you know, Caesar is, you know, a populare, right? And you know, kind of the origin of our term populist, as I understand it, and is talking about, you know, we need to give more, you know, we need tax breaks and we need relief and we need, you know, help for the kind of struggling underclasses of the Roman society. And we need to pay less attention to the Senate. And so, but this is something with like the Gracchi's and, you know, this is a conversation that had been happening in Rome for a long time before Caesar got there. But yeah, then exactly. when Caesar gets there, he both rides the wave of this, you know, this trend towards, you know, a little more liberalization of their society. But he also pushes that wave forward and it feeds on itself. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah, and, you know, there's both in history the way we tell it, but also at the moment when you have a figure like Julius Caesar, what we know of him, you have people that both seem to and also sometimes claim to, you know, personally encapsulate an ideal or a movement or something like that. And even though in reality, whether they're aware of it or not, they're at some point on generally on a much more complex trend of history, right? But that we really can only focus as a people, as a group, we can really only focus on one point. Right. Mm-hmm. Not big, messy, spider webby processes. So that, you know, it's in that sense, it's kind of mutually beneficial. Right. If you are the if you're the agent of change, it's very convenient that people tend to focus on a single agent. It seems like very often. And if you are us, the people who hope to benefit from change, it's fortunate that there's someone who's willing to be the agent of change. And it's you can speak from experience or to some extent common sense, right? That you don't need philosophy, I don't think, to talk about. But it is something, for example, that Hegel, who I, like I said, I'm not an expert or and certainly not a philosopher, but we do teach our history majors a bit about the philosophy of history. And it's something that Hegel really students I know latch onto it, and I certainly latch onto the idea of what he called world historical individuals. And that's what I meant in that interview where I talked about people in spite of themselves. Hegel talks about it. It's what he calls the cunning of reason. He believes that, you know, the world, he believed that the world is getting better. It is progressing. But that if we look at it, it looks like history is cyclical, like the same thing happens over and over again. That is, you know, our daily lives aren't going to necessarily feel like we're progressing toward reason. But Hegel believes that's what's happening. But he believes that when we make big steps closer to, say, a better world, or the world that we ultimately will live in, the world of reason, when we make it, it's almost always not because of our conscious efforts. It's not that we say, so to use Daenerys as an example, it's not because she thinks that in a better world there is no slavery and people are free. Her belief in that concept, even if that concept is true, it's not what is going to force change. What's going to force change in someone like Daenerys, despite herself almost, is the fact that she is passionate and charismatic and overwhelmingly driven toward the throne in Westeros. And the cunning of reason, what Hegel meant by that was that reason itself works through people's passions, because it knows that people are not going to stick to their principles. That's just not how it works. But what people will do is obey self-interest and their passions, and they'll work that way. And that's why someone like Julius Caesar, you know, or Daenerys, right, they can have these principled statements that make them look like agents of change and give them popularity in real time, that people cheer for them and weep for them in the case of Julius Caesar when they're dead. But what really makes Caesar consequential in large historical terms, according to Hegel, is actually all the bad things, his ambition and his egomania, or whatever, you know, you want to call it. It's the stuff that drives him and makes him exceptional. And that's why most agents of change on a sort of world historical level, according to Hegel, they usually end up destroyed, right? Because of their ambition. And so that's the idea of them forcing change despite themselves. And so with someone like Daenerys, for example, you know, is she a world historical individual? It would depend, I think, on whether she, you know, it's not so much her effort to, you know, liberate enslaved peoples. It's really just it's more her drive and her passion in general. And it's hard, you know, when we get to season 7, at least, I don't know what's going to happen in the books, but when we get to season 7, so much of that seems to have dissipated. And right. Now she's just thinking about, oh, maybe there's going to be a marriage with John or whatever. And yeah, that's definitely, there's nothing revolutionary about that. Right. So.
You seem a little disappointed in season 7.
Yeah, well, I don't.
It's okay. It's me too, man. I mean, like, I definitely had my issues. So I'm interested in hearing where it went off the rails for you.
I've read a couple, maybe two or three reactions to it toward the end of the season and after the last episode. And I definitely don't have anything original to say. I think it's and I also don't know, you know, there's speculation about why things, you know, whether we should be very forgiving because the show needs to tie together, or at least feels it needs to tie together all these threads, bring people back together and all that stuff. And certainly, like I said, I don't get hung up on accuracies too much. So, you know, like the distant travel distance that I guess infuriates a lot of people. I don't
even speed of Raven flight.
Honestly. Yeah. I'm kind of tired usually when I'm watching this show. So I don't get hung up on those things, but I do think it, you know, one thing that I noticed, and I know I read that other people noticed too, is one of the really distinctive things about the show in the beginning, and it was interesting to me because I read the books, like I said, in I guess it was like 2015 or something, or no, 2011, I think. And I didn't watch the show until like three or four seasons were out, and then watched some on DVD. But I noticed people reacting to the show and like things like Red Wedding or Ned Stark and this outrage, and it took me a while because I'm kind of, I guess, dumb this way, where I was like, why didn't they I assumed everyone read the book, so I didn't understand why people were so shocked. And then I realized, oh, the vast majority of people don't read the books, and so this is shocking. But it reminded me, you know, like I said earlier, one of the things I liked a lot about the books is that this focus on people who are not, you know, you have the people who the people who are heads of household, but the focus on people who are sort of the second tier down, their advisors. I find that really compelling. Another thing is the fact that people, you know, die at any moment,
right?
And not so much in you know, you could just say, well, that's realistic because everyone dies, but something a little more complicated than that, or nuanced than that, I guess, is that, you know, it's that history is extremely contingent, and it's kind of a version of the history being written by the winners, you know, that's there are all sorts of people who could be game changers but who just die of old age, or who were assassinated, or who just, you know, fail, like find out that they're, you know, it could be what Daenerys is from the perspective of the people that she's left behind, right? Like someone, that looked like it was building up to something and then it didn't. That's something I really liked about it, and it's manifested in the fact that people die sometimes in groups who you don't, yeah. You couldn't have imagined that they ever, that the show would exist or the books would exist without them. And since that's, you know, the thing that most notably, at least so far in season 7, changes, that seems to me like a, you know, a core change. So it's one thing, it's one thing that things are happening faster and stuff like that. That's the constraints of the program, I guess. But you know, I guess the fact that no one died, right? And that you had to have these miraculous escapes. That just doesn't seem like,
yeah,
the same kinda spirit of the rest of the, right, the internal logic, I guess, of the books.
Yeah. One but thing I think,
I don't know.
No, I think that's a fair point. Especially if you've read the books and watched all the, you know, you definitely got used to it. And you know, like, it was great to see Littlefinger die, but it was no Red Wedding, you know. Right. One interesting thing I think they actually do pretty well is the idea that a lot of times the moment that we mark as the moment something changed in a society is a very bad moment for that mm-hmm. society, you know. And whatever those frustrations are that lead to that moment have been building for a long time, but we mark that moment as the moment that thing changed. And, you know, we haven't seen it in the show, but it's been referenced many times that when the dragons finally, you know, were killed in the show, that they were killed by the small folk, right? That the, you know, the average people were tired of having their sheeps and kids cooked by the dragons. And they went nuts and they killed the dragons, you know, and this was kind of the day the big dragons died, you know. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen it. This is another thing that really fell off in season 7, but we certainly saw, you know, consequences for Cersei's actions, you know. Yeah. Well, then she blew up the Sept and everybody just, I guess, is just like scared and, you know, Kat got your tongue, I suppose. Cersei got your tongue, I suppose. But, but we did see, you know, reaction to that. And it seems like that's something that they do in the show where it's actually, and there's another one too, which is the kind of the idea of uniting behind a common enemy is mm-hmm. something else that we see frequently in history. You know, where you see, I mean, just the Greek city states trying to work together when the Persians are coming, and some of them did, most of them didn't, but you saw them trying, you know, in that moment to say, you know, the Night's King is coming, his name is Xerxes, and we need to work together, you know. And right. So I'm kind of, that was one thing I was expecting to see in season 7 that I didn't, was some consequences for the Sept of Baelor, you know, because it's hard to imagine a historical example where something like that would go down and then we just wouldn't talk about it afterwards. You know, you would think that there would be a reaction. But generally, I think they handle that. They use that aspect of history pretty well in the show.
There are a lot of good things. And I thought actually the 7 seasons started off for the most part strong in my view, right? Like you had, and I really liked in the beginning of the seventh season how suddenly you have, for example, women in power everywhere, right? And you really feel like something has dramatically changed if you think in terms of the beginning of the show, and you're trying to wonder what the consequences of this, because it's a game changer in terms of diplomacy and all sorts of other things. And you had that with Daenerys showing up and wondering if there's going to be looking for marriage or not marriage. The same with Cersei. And I thought that was interesting. What you said about the consequences of Cersei's actions were also something that you're kind of waiting to see. And the scene that I when Arya encounters the soldiers and she says she's going to Winterfell and she doesn't, that was a great scene. It's like you mentioned before of sort of bringing the perspective down to ordinary people again, which I thought was important. I just felt like if you think of this as a single season, like, what just finished and what's coming next, then I think by the end, I might be more satisfied, because I think it was building to a crux, and maybe it'll come back to what you were talking about, this larger social perspective, which I think was it's also just that I thought the end of season six, in season six in general, was really, really good. There was a lot of stuff set up, and it was kind of hard to follow.
Yeah, but I think,
and you're also troubled by the fact, like, I don't know what, I probably would feel differently if I knew, for those of us who are watching it, having read the books, right, then I've been satisfied with the show. Like, it doesn't bother me, whatever differences or departures from the book are there, haven't bothered me. But then with this season, when the book is gone, then I guess I'm less certain whether this is okay. And if I thought that it was okay with Martin, then I'd probably be saying, okay. Then I'd be trying to figure out why it was okay.
Well, I try not to be such an ass kisser, but there's really not a whole lot of people who can tell a story like that guy. And like Martin, and it may just really be that without his, pinned out twists and turns, right? If you're working from bullet points, it may not be an insult to say that, two different storytellers starting from the same list of bullet points, one of them's just going to do it better. I don't know. I think that's an excellent perspective of kind of waiting to see, how the last season affects this season. In our kind of judgments. I think that's a good point. Man, we have been chatting for a while now, and I could talk about Trends and Forces for the rest of the day, but I assume you have other things, more important things to do with your life. I really appreciate you coming on and talking to me, man. This has been really great. I love it when I can read articles and then hear the unedited answer later, Yeah. Let me hear that, from your own words. Tell everybody how they can find you and what you would, how you interact with the world.
Yeah, well, my name is Kevin Uhalde, Uhalde. I think if you Google that, you get to my website and my page at Ohio University. That's about it.
All right. Well, we will link the articles. There was an article you did for a Brazilian paper that was then translated in parts, and there's the Slate article. So there's a few things like that we talked about today that we'll link in the show notes. Excellent. And we'll put up some of your other stuff too, so everybody can go and check it out.
Okay.
Kevin Uhalde, I really appreciate you coming on. It's been a great chat. This has been Podcast Winterfell. And Axel is going to tell you how you can find us. Send us your reactions to Season 7. We're going to be doing a big feedback episode coming up soon. So thanks for listening, everybody. Talk to you later.
Thank you for listening to Podcast Winterfell. podcast Winterfell is a part of the DVR Podcast Network. You can check us out at dvrpodcast.com. Become a patron. Go to patreon.com/DVR. Follow us on Twitter at Winterfell Pod. Follow us on Facebook at Podcast Winterfell. And follow the DVR Podcast Network at DVR Podcast.